Hello and welcome back to Tabling the Podcast. My name is Ariana Karp and this week I am joined by Zoe Goslin, Chasen Schneider, and Will McKay as we work our way through Act 2 of William Shakespeare's King Henry IV, Part 1. A few of the topics that we discuss in this episode are the more archaic working class language of the Carriers in Act 2, Scene 1, the rapid shift in tone and setting from the end of Act 1 to the beginning of Act 2, the insight that the early scenes in Act 2 give into the underworld of the thieves and how they interact with the servant class, the Gadshill robbery, masculine pranksters, and the continuing development of the relationship between Hal and Falstaff, and the audience's investment in Hotspur's character as we see him in a private scene with his wife, Lady Percy. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this week's episode of Tabling King Henry IV, Part 1. And welcome back to Tabling, the podcast. My name is Ariana Karp, and this week I am joined by
Zoe Goslin,
Chasen Schneider,
Will McKay.
Thank you all so much for being here. We are discussing King Henry IV, Part 1, Act 2, and you can find the cold read of this on our website at tablingpodcast.com. So off we go. Act 2, Scene 1, a scene which is normally cut, but a scene which I find fascinating. It ties into what I sort of talked about in the introductory episode about Shakespeare showing us an encyclopedic look at 15th century England, essentially, and 16th century England. And that's what I love so much, is these carriers, the last scene we saw was in the throne room with these guys planning a rebellion, literally in the throne room against the king. And the next scene we see is these basically truck drivers. That's what they're doing. They're moving goods from one place to another. Talking about fleas and pissing in the chimney because they don't have toilets. And like how, God, this hotel used to be so much better, but Robin died and it's been really run down. It's like the most like human like thing ever. And I just love the way that shift happens. And that's why I really love this scene.
Also, it is really hard to understand.
It's no idea what was happening.
It says like a lot of very archaic lines.
Yeah.
I literally wrote
Shakespeare
2.1, what just happened?
So I want to get into that. I want to get into that. So what does happen, right? There's a lot of really funny jokes that you can work into this scene. So he says like, right, he says, "Ayo," just an expression, right? "And it be not 4 by the day, and it's not 4 a.m., I'll be hanged," blah, 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 blah. "Charles Wayne is over New Chimney." There's a lot of archaic language. I think a lot of it can be conveyed in the way that the carriers are dressed and like how they're talking and they're just like yelling. Essentially, I think truck drivers, right? It's very like working class people talking about their merchandise and all this fun stuff.
And it's just to like set the scene.
Set the scene, right. Exactly.
The idea of the scene is cool, but like, what are they saying?
Yeah. So, like, beat cuts saddle. Beating a saddle like softens the saddle. Poor Jade. Like, they're talking about how their like horses are not being taken care of.
They're just like shooting the shit.
Yeah, absolutely. And then like the second carrier comes in and he's like, "Dude, the food here is fucking awful. This used to be like a really nice hotel, and it's gone to shit since what's his name, the innkeeper, died." Mm. And then they're talking about fleas. They're like, "I am lying here in bed, and I'm getting covered in fleas, and I'm getting like bitten, and I'm." And then there's this great joke that the first carrier says, like, "I'm bit more than a Christian king," which like a Christian king wouldn't be bit by fleas because they're not around fleas. So there's just like all of these really weird malapropisms and like hilarious, like if again, it's like so important, right, that the actor understands what they're saying in that moment, which this scene you would really need to pick apart. But I think there's really, there's a lot of like itching acting and like, ah, fucking, you know, and all this stuff. Really, and then they like, they see the turkeys and they're like, you haven't been feeding my fucking turkeys, man. Fuck you. And then Gatsby comes in and Gatsby's a thief and they sort of get this whole, they're like, yeah, what do you want? What do you want? And then he's like, what time is it? And the first carrier's just said it's 4 a.m. But the first carrier, like, looks at him and he's like, it's 2 a.m. I'm like, there's all of these just, like, really weird, non sequitur, like, very strange jokes in this first section. And so you see that Gatzel's trying to get information about them because they're going with these travelers. They're carrying goods from one place to another. They're a prime target to be robbed. Then the Chamberlain comes in, and he's sort of like, in the innkeeper, he's like the guy who, you know, attends to people's rooms and, like, makes sure they have everything they need. And he's a total sketchball, right? He just come in, and he's like, yeah, so those guys that just left, they're leaving, they're going on this path, they're leaving. If you rob them, give me some of the money, and I'll, like, deal with it.
Apparently,
so it's like
back
these...
then.
Yeah.
The innkeeper's servants were often regarded to be thieves.
Yeah.
I think actually in the Art and Shakespeare I was reading, there was a quote by a contemporary author who said something like, it's like out of all of like the thieves in this kingdom, I'm sure that they had in part at least like 90 out of 100, something like that.
Yeah. It's pretty remarkable though to think about the way that like, yeah, so obviously the servants of these innkeepers
it's
were not making
Tenardian.
A lot of money. Yeah, so they're, like, making
like
all these deals with the thieves. Like, okay, I'll tell you who has money and where they're going and where you should hit them, essentially.
Right.
They're, like, the informant. You know, if you're watching, like, a heist movie or something, like Ocean's 11 or something, it's the you know, hotel manager that's like, okay, so they're in this room and this room, and give me $1 million and I'll give you more information. Mm. So it's that kind of interaction. So I think it just, I understand why it's cut frequently because it's got a lot of archaic language, but I think if you do understand what they're saying, it's really fucking funny.
Right.
And it also sets up this world of, like, this sort of underworld of, like, really seedy people, like, looking out for themselves. So that's just really all I wanted to say and why I wanted to read that.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the hardest scenes in the play in terms of picking apart meaning, like I said.
Right.
And it's all in prose, right? So that requires a different kind of attention. So then we'll just swiftly move on through that part.
This act is just like the seedy underbelly.
Seedy
act.
Underbelly, yeah. It's the zoom in on the tavern, right?
And then
it's,
like a little of the Hotspurs.
Yeah.
Sprinkled in.
Sprinkle of Hotspurs.
Yeah.
So then our next scene is the famous robbery at Gad's Hill, where the thieves get robbed by some other thieves, which is just Hal and Poins in disguise. This Falstaff speech is like, I think, one of the funniest speeches in the play. Like, he has so much antithetical language, right? He's talking like, I'm accursed to rob in that thieves' company. Like, like all of these lines that are just like, I'm a thief, and by God, I'll never rob in that other thieves' company. And like, his line about, like, Prince Hal's like, why don't you lie down and lay your ear to the ground and see if you can, like, hear them coming. And he's like, do you have any levers to lift me up again? Because I'm not getting up.
Yeah.
If I'm going down, like, you're going to have to, like, help me up. And there's so many just, like, wonderful little moments like that. And all of their insults to each other that really, for me, like, we saw the first scene with the two of them, the second scene of the play. And this is, like, a further development to me of their wonderfully close relationship. And, you know, he calls him a fat kidneyed rascal, and there's all of these he calls him peace ye fat guts, and
Hal is really mean to him.
But in a jokey way,
I'm gonna give you nookies and like
exactly.
whatever.
Exactly.
That's but that's sort of like a lot of guy things. It's like
there's
a lot of guys for whom,
come
like,
on, you douchebag!
The way of bonding is we insult each other. Because it's like, I think, because like, and there's this old, in the terms of like, you know, which is not being looked favorably upon anymore, but like in terms of like the kind of like quote unquote old school masculinity, I think part of that comes from like there was this idea that like the type of things that would normally be said to you that would cause you to get ready for a fight that you're saying that to each other as if as a form of bonding. To say, if normally, if anyone else said that to me, I'd be ready to get into a fight to protect my honor. But you're so close to me that you can call me a douchebag, scumbag, coward. And I'll just laugh and give you a hug or a noogie because I know that you're that close to me. So I'm allowing you to use things that no one else is allowed to use.
Men are very strange.
I think it's the age difference, too. Obviously, like, Poins and Hal are closer. Well, Poins is usually cast, like, being an sort of like an equivalent to Hal in age. And I think the fact that their relationship is, well, you were saying, like, it's the, like, two fathers. It's Henry versus Falstaff as, like, Hal's two fathers.
But Falstaff's also the child as well.
Oh, absolutely. And there's that thing, though, of it, like Zoe was saying, you know, I very much, you could subtitle this play, I think, The Education of Prince Hal. And I think, or The Rebellion of Hotspur, or The Antics of Falstaff. You really could, it could be a very...
Or just Falstaff.
Falstaff. and I just wanted to share this quote from Orson Welles. He was being interviewed, basically, about his idea of Falstaff and his portrayal he famously made in, I think it was 1965.
Chimes at Midnight.
Yes, he made this movie that was called The Chimes at Midnight, which was basically a compilation of all the Falstaff scenes from the three plays in which he is in, which is Henry IV Part 1, Henry IV Part 2, and Merry Wives of Windsor, which was written at Queen Elizabeth's behest because she said, I want to see Falstaff in love, write me a play. And Shakespeare probably wrote The Merry Wives of Windsor in a week. Which is probably why it's entirely in prose. And as to quote Rodney Cotier, it's Shakespeare's only sitcom.
Not my favorite. Spinoffs for money are a lot older than you think.
But so I just, to go on that whole sort of father and child, both encapsulated in Falstaff, I just wanted to read this quote. I've sort of done little ellipses along the way because it's very long and drawn out. But so Orson Welles said about Falstaff, I think Shakespeare was greatly preoccupied with the loss of innocence. I think there has always been in England, an older England, which was sweeter and purer, where the hay smelled better and the weather was always springtime. You feel a nostalgia for it in Shakespeare. His villains are modern creations. They're modern people. I think he was a typically English writer, the perfect English writer, in fact. Innocence is what Falstaff is. He is a refugee from that sweeter England, and he's living in the modern age, which I just thought was a really interesting perspective on him. He's sort of like the springtime child that had been transferred to the modern age. And I think he...
Well, he sort of walks directly out of Chaucer, doesn't he?
Yes, exactly. He talks about, actually, part of the quote that I didn't say was that Orson Welles talks about, you feel the nostalgia for this sweeter England in Chaucer as well. There's always this idea of there was a time past where everything was sweeter.
Member berries.
Oh, good old, But so I think there's a bit of that in here. And even some of the punning that the two of them have, I think it's just some of my favorite in Shakespeare. Like the line... what a plague ye mean ye to colt me thus, and colt meant like to cheat me. Why are you cheating me? And then he can't find his horse, so Hal picks up on the other meaning of colt, which is like a young horse. He goes, you're not colted, you're uncolted, because you can't find your horse, you know? And so it's just like all of these like fun things. And one of my favorite lines is like Poins goes, oh, Sirrah Jack, thy horse stands behind the hedge. You know, you were looking for it in front of the hedge. You have to go all the way around because it's behind the hedge. And it's just like all of this really fun... Jack, you know, we there's a throwback to Richard II in this, but, you know, Prince Hal says, what a coward Sir John Paunch, you know, meaning like Mr. Fatty. And he goes, indeed, I am not John of Gaunt, your grandfather. And we've seen John of Gaunt in Richard II. And he makes so many puns about his own name. Gaunt am I as the grave. Gaunt as a grave. I am Gaunt. You know, like, so there's so much sort of playing around.
I have a big question, I guess. Yeah. A general question about Falstaff. Like, how aware is he? Like, is he actually just playing this game with Hal, and he's, like, totally aware I mean, not the whole, like, being tricked. Not that stuff, but, like, the witty banter that they have. Like, part of me feels like he kind of has to do it with, like, a wink and a... Because otherwise it's just too... I don't know. Like, I don't think Falstaff is stupid.
Oh, no. I actually think Falstaff is one of the most intelligent characters in Shakespeare.
He is, right?
He can.
And, like, his speech about honor, which comes later, is, like, one of the most brilliant... And, like, it's all, he's always very funny, and he's always sort of, you know, he lets Hal make fun of him.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of, like, their agreement.
Yes, I would totally agree with that. And I think one of the things that I love so much about Falstaff, and one of the things, if you read Harold Bloom's book, which is pretty much just about Falstaff and Hamlet, his two favorite characters. But, you know, Falstaff is not a clown.
Right.
He's much more, if he were to be one thing, he would be closer, I think, to a fool, like Festy or King Lear's fool, where he sees the truth. He is funny, but we laugh with him. We very rarely laugh at him.
Right.
You know, we laugh with him and we enjoy laughing with him, like, because
a fool
he's
on the hill type person.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, like, even when he's been caught out later and he's like, I knew it was you the whole time.
He
always has a way of sort of
wiggling out of very tight spots.
But he's also
even though
aware
he's so
of
big.
How ridiculous he is.
Oh yeah.
And I think he also has that he's preoccupied, I think, with the constant awareness of the nature of his relationship with Hal being essentially incompatible, and that there's an anxiety underneath everything that he does with Hal that comes from that.
I agree.
The jokes, a lot of the, like, jokiness, all of his jokes are about, like, you're gonna be king and I'm just an asshole, but you're gonna be king. that's kind of, I think, all of that is coming from this real sense
he's aware that
Hal is very shortly going to be moving on.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's why, to skip ahead to the tavern scene, I think that's why the play within a play is so powerful, because I think at some point, and we were just actually watching before we did this, the Globe production with Roger Allam as Falstaff and Jamie Parker as Hal.
I love them both.
Wonderful rendition of the scene. And what I really enjoy about this is that oftentimes it's just sort of played, and I think I probably did this, as, like, Hal is, like, joking until a point where he's not. And then he's like, But what I really loved about the way they did that, when Hal is playing his father, is he would still, like, break character. He would still break character and have moments where he was just like, I can't with you. You're just so funny. You know, with Falstaff. But then, of course, that line, I do, I will, is so... I think you hear that... The language is very complicated in that scene. There's a lot of archaic words, but I do, I will has got to be the clearest, most simplistic language. And I think you see the reflection of it. It ripples through to the next play with the most, I think, devastating line possibly in all of Shakespeare, and one of the simplest lines, I know thee not, old man, which is, you know, all monosyllabic words. And it's so amazing to me in Shakespeare, where he can come up with these unbelievably complex and multisyllabic Latinate words, and then he will suddenly switch when shit gets real to these short, powerful Anglo-Saxon words, you know? He does it in Macbeth to a great effectiveness, I think. When Macbeth has just killed the king, and he suddenly goes into, after Lady Macbeth goes to smear the garments with it, he sort of goes into this language where he says, you know, the multitudinous seas incarnadine, all of these Latinate multisyllabic words, and then as soon as the next line is making the green one red, he goes right into these Anglo-Saxon simplistic powerful words. And I think he does the same here, you know, banish not, as soon as when Falstaff is trying to excuse his own behavior,
when shit gets real,
he's using these big words. But when he starts really pleading with Hal, like, banish not him, thy Harry's company. Banish not him, thy Harry's company. Banish plump Jack, and banish all the world. I do, I will.
Never,
it's incredibly
never.
Just
and
simple.
That he says it twice.
Yeah, the fact that he says it twice, I think, is one of the only
that's
times
like
in Shakespeare that that's
big
done.
Clue.
Yeah.
A complete sentence repeated twice.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and repetition is so important in
right.
Shakespeare.
You always
never,
have to
never,
ask
never,
why.
Never, 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 never. My other favorite repetition.
But I think that line, banish not.
Because it, right.
That Harry's company is, that is, that is the heart of Falstaff for the
yeah.
whole thing. And
mm-hmm.
for the whole of the
well,
robbery
and
scene and the whole of everything, all of his jokes with Hal, is that is always underneath it.
And banish Plump Jack and banish all the world. Because to us, like, Falstaff is essentially, he's a life-affirming character. He's incredibly, to use Lobin terms, he, like, lives in nearness. But I think he has this sort of a dream
yeah.
quality about him.
I mean, that's why I like Falstaff. I like Falstaff
yeah.
for his melancholy awareness.
Yeah.
I don't actually...
He talks about it in the first scene, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, I that's what makes him interesting to me.
Yeah.
I don't watch him for the laughs, necessarily.
Yeah.
It's also because we know that... I mean, it's that question again of, like, why watch a Shakespeare comedy? Because you know all the punchlines.
Yeah.
Like, and how is it still funny? Like, the whole scene where they're revealing... Where Hal and Poins are revealing that they were the ones that
yeah.
that ended up robbing them.
Yeah.
You know that Falstaff is going to be like, I knew it was you.
Yeah.
And that's like the big like laugh. That's like
yeah.
the big reveal. Like, how is he going to get out of this one?
Yeah.
But we know how he gets out of it. So
yeah.
it's to me, yeah, it's all of the subtext.
And it's sort
that
of watching
it.
The process too,
right.
right? I mean, that's the thing with Shakespeare. I think so often it's, well, so often as the actor, the much more rewarding part, I think, of doing Shakespeare is the process, is the process of discovering, of picking apart each of these big ideas and big moments. And then, you know, the product is the thing that the audience sees, but really, probably the most rewarding thing, at least for me, I'm just speaking for myself,
and
is
I,
the process of
it's
delving
funny,
into the text.
Because there are a lot of people who say that, like, there's no subtext in Shakespeare. But
oh my
I think,
God!
I think that's a kind of an insult to Shakespeare's intelligence.
Absolutely.
And a lot of people's reasoning is that Freudian psychology wasn't a thing back then. It's like, well, yeah, that's true,
that's
but
the stupidest thing I've ever heard
but
in my life.
Even back, but even back then, but they teach that in like famous drama schools, including
yeah.
some we've went to.
There's one acting teacher at Northwestern who teaches.
And I
yeah.
think that it's yeah maybe yeah
but
it's
no
true that
subtext.
They did, it's true that they didn't have Freudian psychology back then, and I must say I think the Freudian analysis of Hamlet ruins Hamlet.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
but that even though they didn't have Freudian psychology, it was still a very known fact that people didn't always mean what they said.
Yeah.
And that they don't always know themselves as well as they think that they do.
Yeah.
People have always known that.
Yeah.
Even before Shakespeare.
It's also a well, you know, discussed idea that Shakespeare was one of the first people to write human
with interiority.
With as much interiority and as much
right.
Complexity of psychology that's portrayed
right.
in such a deft way through subtext and
also,
through
yeah.
you know what is inferred about the person, not what they directly say.
Well, and that's the thing too, is you couldn't have villains without subtext too. That's my that's always my thing is
or humor.
It makes or humor. You can't have, like, if you were to take Iago and take everything he's saying at face value, he disappears. There has to be something driving him.
Right.
And he doesn't talk about what's driving him,
right.
really.
Yeah.
So we want to know, and that's
I actually do think, though,
you know?
He is more interesting as a sociopath, because there are people who exist who are like that, who
yeah.
just do it because that's their nature.
Right.
Yeah, but again,
so,
that's still, there's still
there
kind of
a
an...
Choice
there has to be
made.
A choice that's made about what is in the interiority
right.
of the character.
Yeah.
And I think with Falstaff, you know, he wants to put on a show. I mean,
yeah.
the whole, the retell is one of my favorite moments in the play. The retelling of how, like, there were two guys, and I
yeah.
got all four of
it's
them,
so
and
good.
Then I got seven, and I took all seven of their 11 points on my target thus. And Hal is like, dude, how did... Monstrous. 11 buckram
right.
men grown out of two. That's pretty
yeah.
impressive. Like, how did 11 come from two? You know, and it's... But it's so, like, you get the feeling, and I think that's why you always have to have tavern guests. I think Falstaff is one of those people that constantly needs an audience, because he's like, and then what happened? was then big up. You know, he like tells a really good story. And I always think it's one of those things where like the tavern is kind of like lackadaisically just there. There, everyone's sort of drinking. And then Falstaff comes in and everyone comes out of the woodwork and they're like, what's he going to say today?
Yeah.
And that is my favorite interpretation of the play, is that like, he is, you know, as Mistress Quickly says, he doth it like one of these harlotry players as ever I see. Like, he's amazing to watch. He's amazing to sort of witness him telling a story or pretending to be the king or whatever it is. Or, you know, Roger Allen, like, sticking the dagger up his nose and clearing it out in the middle of pretending to be the king. And you're just like, that is a ridiculous thing to do, but I'm fascinated and I want to watch it. But, and then I think it's really, he shows his intelligence in a very big way when he plays the king, because he's using all of these like incredibly archaic styles of speaking. You know, he says, I'll do it in King Cambyses' vein. And there's this whole thing of him being, he's imitating the sort of grand dramatic work of the time, you know, and it's like Shakespeare making fun of some of his contemporaries. You know, and this incredibly structured language. Now do I not speak to thee in drink, but in tears. Not in pleasure, but in passion. Not in words only, but in woes also. You know, it's like, it's this perfectly balanced language that somehow, like, makes it not that human.
Right.
In a way. But it's like, Falstaff is imitating a style of the time. Right. And that's what's so brilliant about that. And he's, all of these, like, very strange, like, shall the son of heaven prove a mitcher and eat blackberries. Like, what is that?
Yeah,
and the chamomile, the more distraught, and like over the top metaphors and all of this incredibly structured archaic language that like nobody talks like that. Even in Shakespeare's time, it's like Shakespeare making fun of academic writers, you know? And so
and
I think,
Falstaff the mind.
Exactly.
To be able to do that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
well, it's also the sort of, you know, the idea that so-called common people or something are always sort of making fun of fancy talk.
And, yes.
You know, making fun of people who use big fancy words and so on and so forth. But the fact is, you know, the stuff the Falstaff comes up with is totally perfect.
Oh, it's so brilliant.
You
know?
Yeah.
So brilliant. And I, you know, just to switch to Hal for a moment, I find it is very, talk about the difficult and kind of opaque language. His first speech, which is that really long prose speech,
very difficult,
incredibly difficult one, but I think very important, because he's talking about what he's been doing. Where have you been, Hal? And he's been hanging out with the guys that pour beer. Mm-hmm. He's been hanging out with the servants of the servants. He has this great line where he talks about, you know, when I am king of England, I think it's the most important line in this speech. When I am king of England, I will command all the good lads in Eastcheap. And by that, I don't think he means command. Mm-hmm. I will be able to understand all of these guys. Tom, Dick, and Francis. It's so good, you know, right? And he's been drinking with these guys. And he's trying to understand them. And I think that goes to why he was such a good ruler. In a way, you can take that as like a Machiavellian, like he's trying to understand these people so that he can sort of control them or whatever. But I really think there's such a warmth to the way he talks about them, that if it's purely Machiavellian, it really just takes away from his character to me.
Right.
And that's the thing, is like,
because
the worst Hal I saw, it was like, he just didn't like anyone.
But
he was just there to like watch people.
I think the warmth
people.
Is the subtext.
Yeah.
That's what makes it interesting. Because basically, he does some shitty
oh,
things.
So shitty!
Like, he makes fun of people all the time.
Yeah.
Not to mention, like, actually scaring Falstaff and, like, just for fun.
Yeah.
Like, just, and he takes this money that they just robbed from these people. Like, he's not, like, a great, he doesn't, like, take it to give it back.
He does give it back, which is the important part.
Oh, he gives it back.
Which he says at the end, the money shall be paid again with advantage.
So he is like a little.
So he is like, it's kind of funny.
But it's because he's like, he can do whatever he wants.
Yeah, exactly.
He's the fucking prince.
Yeah.
So it is like, there is this complete arrogance to have.
Oh, completely.
And it's weird, because you always feel sort of, you're like, why do I still like you?
Yeah. And that's what like a lot of critics have said, is that Prince Hal is like a weirdly, you like don't like him and you like him at the same time. He's like weirdly
super
charming, but he's actually kind of an asshole too.
Well, why do all of the tavern people like him so much? because they all love him.
They love him. They all call him Sweet Hal.
He has money and he pays for everything.
Yeah.
You could boil it down to that.
You could, I suppose.
You really could. And because they have to, because he's the prince.
I don't know. There's a lot of psychology in that.
Yeah.
Because they have to. I mean, they have to.
Some people really don't want anything more than just you buying them buying you shit and giving you food.
But I think they also think that he's... on a really basic level, that it's just really awesome that the prince would want to hang out with,
like,
John,
yeah,
you know.
Because when would that happen? That a crown prince, who's the next in line for the throne,
but celebrities,
comes and hang
celebrities
out
are always doing this. You know, it's always like, yesterday was on the news that Tom Hanks dropped by somebody's
phone
and took a picture, and it's like everybody's like, "Oh, Tom Hanks is so cool because he took a picture with us lowly people."
Right.
Which,
yet Tom Hanks isn't gonna give a soliloquy saying like, "I know that this looks bad, but don't worry, like, these mofos don't even, like, that's why the "I know you all" speech is so, I don't know, problematic in a weird way. Because it is, you see him with these people, and I genuinely believe, I mean, I'm playing devil's advocate, I genuinely believe that Hal does care about these
people. I think
people
there's
that
a,
he surrounds
the
himself
warmth.
With the warmth.
If he's played as entirely cold... to
who
me,
cares,
it
right.
Exactly. It becomes a two-dimensional play. And if he genuinely does feel affection, that's the thing is, right, as a director, when you're looking at the play, you're like, what does it cost you? Like, so for me, it's like, what would it cost Hal? It has to cost him something to reject these people.
Exactly.
Otherwise, the play is fucking pointless.
Well, that's what's so,
you know,
kind of, that's the heart of the play and the heart of what makes it, like, interesting. Him as a character is that he's... he loves these people and at the same time has a perspective that knows that he will, that they're not his people and that he will
one day reject
them.
Well, and that's, to me, is why that's actually one of my favorite moments in Branagh's Henry V is how choked up he gets when he has to hang Bardolph, who you've seen him
that part is, oh
in
my God,
three plays hanging out with, and then he has to hang Bardolph.
I cried in the Hollow Crown. I cried when
it's
Bardolph
so horrible.
Hanged.
Yeah,
it's
horrible. And I was having a discussion with someone. We were talking about how it's like important to Hal that he does that.
Right.
As Henry, he has to do it because he said
the man
he made
who
this proclamation.
The swings the sword.
Exactly. Thank you, George R.R. for stealing that thing. But it is, it's kind of that idea of like. I have a responsibility to be a leader. And if you see him having to make sacrifices,
right,
you understand why he was the hero king of England.
And that, I think it's really important, this is just my opinion on how Hal should be played,
yeah,
but that he doesn't know that he's going to be great.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
And that is the way I think people should interpret that "I know you all" speak. Just because that's like the basis of his character, which is why I keep going back to it, I guess. Or I feel it's the basis of his character.
It's his only
but
soliloquy.
Talking about himself as like a piece of shiny like metal on the sullen ground or whatever. Like, I'm so amazing. He can't actually think that he's amazing, but he's burdened with being the prince.
Well,
and
he's
burdened with the promise of the future,
exactly,
right? As opposed to Henry, as we've talked about. Henry is, like, Henry IV is haunted by the past.
Future, yeah.
And Hal is kind of haunted by the expectation of his kingship, you know, and that.
And he's talking himself into it.
Yeah.
He's like, "Don't worry, you guys.
Yeah.
It'll be great."
Well, and that's, I think that's such a key moment where he says in this speech, "My reformation glittering are my fault." Because the base metal is still him. That's the thing that I think is so important about that speech is when he's talking about the glittering thing, when he's talking about the base metal and the barren earth, that's part of him too. He's saying, that's me. It's not just the people I'm hanging out with, which are like salt of the earth, so to speak. He said, I am exhibiting right now. I am living life as that base metal. The Reformation might be the crowning jewel of myself as a human, but I'm also going to set it off by my own behavior. It's not, to me, it's like, it's not so much about the people I'm hanging out with. It's my own behavior and the way I've exhibited myself.
And it's also the thing of, I think there has to be an energy under that speech of, I'm promising myself that I will man up and do this.
Yeah.
Right.
And and be.
I don't know how I'm going
to
do it.
Live up
but
to the
I,
expectation
yeah.
of my father and of my country.
Yeah.
Even though I'm screwing around now, it's like
yeah.
he's.
He feels yeah. that you feel the weight.
And why does he do that? Because
yeah.
he's just agreed to rob somebody, and he
right.
needs to remind himself, okay.
Yeah.
But I will man up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's what's so interesting to me is it is all fun and games, but then when
until
I always think when
somebody gets robbed.
Until somebody gets robbed, then it's hilarious, right? But I always think, you know, when the sheriff comes in, and there's a really, I was talking with Patrick, who I wish could be here, because we had a very interesting conversation about Falstaff, but what's really fascinating is, do you make the choice, I mean, it doesn't matter if you're only doing Henry the Fourth Part 1, but if you go to Henry the Fourth Part 2, Hal's relationship with the Lord Chief Justice, do you make the sheriff the Lord Chief Justice? Because there's all of this backstory that we never see with the Lord Chief Justice and Hal. The Lord Chief Justice at one point arrested him. The Crown Prince put him in jail. And Hal, like, holds on to that as the whole thing. And I think he's jilting the sheriff in this moment. He's, like, giving the middle finger to the sheriff.
Yeah.
Because the sheriff's like, good night, my noble lord. And he's like, is it really night?
Yeah.
Asshole? And he's like, no. It's 2 a.m. You know? It's like such a great, like, that to me is where you
see
Hal being
yeah.
like, fuck you, authority,
yeah.
you know?
Right.
But, like, before that, when he's, like, joking around, you see him sort of put on the trappings of authority. But I think there is a little bit
that's
of a rebel, like, in
know,
him, where he's like,
because otherwise
fuck you,
he's just a twit.
Establishment.
He's like,
yeah.
I can get away with it because
yeah.
I'm the prince.
No, he's got thrown into jail,
yeah.
which is, like, insane.
The fact that he's still
yeah.
risking that he has something to lose.
Yeah,
I guess.
Absolutely. I think it adds more and more complexity to his character.
Right.
Anyway, I love talking about Prince Hal, obviously, because, as I said before, I've played him.
Who
and I just find him a fascinating, fascinating man. But I also... So there's this whole part that we skipped over, the scene with Hotspur and Lady Percy,
oh,
which is
scene.
A wonderful scene and one of the only women in the play.
Oh my God,
in
I was
her
painfully aware of that, I have to say.
Yeah.
One of the things that I dislike about these histories is that there are no
there's very
women
few women
found anywhere.
But when they do pop up,
they're fucking awesome.
They're amazing. They're amazing characters.
But
Lady Percy is like, I love that we see Hotspur in this. I always think it's important, you know, when you're looking at the play, what scenes are public, what scenes are private, and when do you have a private moment in public, which are probably the most potent moments of all.
I like...
This is a very private scene, right? It's a domestic
right.
scene.
I like to think that this couple... I know you would say Macbeth.
Yeah.
But I like to think the Hotspurs are...
The most
in
love
couple in
yeah.
all of Shakespeare.
I think so.
That's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you say that?
Well, part of it is like her language, and I really like it when Kate is like just really, I don't know, like overtly sexual,
yeah.
I guess. Kind of like rowdy.
Yeah.
Like, doesn't give a fuck. Like, well, you were just saying the difference between public and private. And
yeah.
I think for her, it doesn't really change that much.
Yeah.
Whereas Hotspur...
Well, we never really see her in a public scene either.
Well, I just mean,
yeah.
like, with the servant coming in.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
totally.
Like, their private life versus when somebody else enters
yeah.
the scene.
That's a good
doesn't
point.
Really change a lot for her.
Yeah.
And the whole line when she's like, I'll break thy little finger, Harry... Like, literally, she's grabbing
I'm
by
break
the dick.
Your penis. Yeah, no.
She's like, I will rip it off.
It's also like, it's such a...
Right now.
We didn't even talk about all of the dick jokes in here, but there's so many of
An
them.
An immeasurable
so funny.
Number of dick jokes. But,
my favorite insults that Falstaff calls Hal is you bull's pizzle. You dried
is,
bull's penis.
Gross.
I mean, like, what is
that?
Gross. But apparently, oh, yeah. I was just reading in the notes... A dried bull's penis was something that you could use as a whip.
Interesting.
Did they
fun
like,
fact?
Fun fact.
Did they like beat it out until it was like a long strip of leather or something?
I don't know that they needed to. It was a, it's a bull, like there's a reason it's called a bull. Anyway, all this fun stuff aside.
Back to the love.
Back
to the
love.
I think they're super in
what,
love.
Do you think that's unrelated?
maybe not.
Just penises.
Good,
just penis junk.
Very good point, Chase. Thank you. No, that's a good point.
But I'd like to see this scene done. I don't know if I've ever seen it done completely this way with this through line, but I really think it needs to be done as though Hotspur needs to leave or he's not going to leave.
Like, yeah.
I think he has to love her so much and not want to leave her. And I think he makes the decision in the scene to be like, you'll come later.
Yeah.
Like, I think he's trying to get out. He's trying to get out. He has a job to do.
Yeah.
He's trying to get out. And she's like, but what, like, come on, dude, seriously?
Yeah.
And he's like, no, okay. And that's
you'll come tomorrow. You'll come and meet me.
He has
tomorrow.
To make that decision
that's
in
good.
That scene.
I like that.
And the point. I mean, I also think to get as far as like being like, I don't love you. Never goodbye. Like never mind. Like that is hilarious to me, and I find it to be. I mean, it's one of the reasons I love Hotspur so much is because I think
he's terribly awkward.
He's terribly awkward.
Like, he just has no idea how to behave in front of anyone.
And I love in the Hollow Crown, like, the scene later where they're... Are they with Glenn Dower or whatever?
Yeah,
where
Glenn Dower and Mortimer and Lady Mortimer. Yeah.
And they're just kind of, like, feeling each other up while this guy is playing a lute or whatever.
So funny.
And I think it's, like, wonderful. I totally...
They just, like, leave in the middle of it
to,
like, go have sex.
Right.
It's
I
so
think
funny.
Just, like, super, like,
yeah.
newlywed, like, lusty.
Yeah.
Totally
yeah.
all about each other. Couple.
Yeah.
Also, because you need... I mean, you kind of already love Hotspur, but having... Showing how much someone else loves a character makes you love them more.
Yeah, it's
and
very
so I
true,
think you really need to not want him to die. You really need to not want him to
die. You need to be torn at the end.
You need to be
how,
torn,
cause
you and
kind
you don't
of
know
are...
how to die
no,
either, and you
exactly.
don't know what to do when they confront each other. You don't know who to side with,
which is probably the most Shakespearean fight setup in
right.
the entire
it's
canon
beautiful.
To me. It's like my favorite setup because you're rooting for
you're
both
rooting
characters.
For both. Yeah,
and you're like. I don't know who I want to win.
Right.
Like,
and because
I
they're
don't.
The same. They're
yeah.
like two sides of the same
it's
coin.
It's so
yeah.
sad when he has to kill him.
It's so
yeah.
heartbreaking.
And
that, part of
yeah.
that is because of Lady Percy and because of the scene.
Yeah. And you have a vested interest in their relationship, too.
Exactly.
Well, which is really established
and
in
they're
this
not,
relationship.
I mean, they have
yeah.
two scenes
yeah.
in this whole play.
Well,
like, sure. she's not a main character. I mean, I guess she's the biggest female character, but she's
yeah.
not, like... in the play.
Yeah.
But her presence means a lot for
absolutely.
Him.
Something
yeah.
that Orson Welles does quite well, speaking of Hotspur and Hal's fight in Chimes of Midnight, is they have this fight, and because it was something that Orson Welles does in that movie quite well, is that he balances out the like kind of like the beauty and the art of like Shakespeare's language and themes with the just sort of messy reality of what those situations would actually look like in a realistic setting.
Yeah.
So like Hal and Harry have this great fight, Henry I should say. No, fucking hell. Hotspur.
There's
so,
three Henrys in this play
yeah,
and they're all
so,
main
so.
Characters. It's very confusing.
Hal
slightly
and
different nicknames.
Yeah. Hal, Harry, and Henry.
Hal and Hotspur, they fight, and then, Hotspur's dying, and Hal's holding him in his arms, and all this, like, beautiful light shining on his face, and it's like the stereotypical sort of classic Shakespearean death scene where he's looking up, and he's saying all these things, he's like, oh, and he's like, oh, and then Falstaff comes along, and he's like, oh, Hal, look what we've got here, and then, like, all of a sudden, it just goes back to this really sort of naturalistic, like, grainy, sort of, like, black and white lighting,
yeah.
and he picks him up, and he throws him over his shoulder, and he's walking to the king, and they're arguing over who gets to have like the bounty for the kill. And then he throws him onto the ground, and there's a cut shot of him being like that, and
yeah.
his tongue's just hanging out of his mouth, and he's just
oh my
lying
God.
There.
Didn't
it's
he
just,
stab him a couple times?
Yeah, he stabs him when he's dead.
Like
in the thigh.
What the fuck?
Because he's
so,
like, I'm gonna claim that he did the same thing I did, which
like,
was pretend to be dead, and then got up and we fought again.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
I mean,
and that's in Shakespeare, too. So it's like this contrast between like this beautifully noble
right.
death
ending,
and just another
and then,
dead body.
Yeah.
And it's proving Falstaff's point, which is just like...
There's honor for you.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that's what's so, to me, so brilliant is, like, you have that beautiful death scene, and, like, I love that Hotspur, when he's dying, calls Hal Harry. He goes, oh, Harry, thou hast robbed me of my youth. You know, and his regret is not that he's dying, it's it's sort of that old chivalric thing where if you killed a great warrior, their deeds became your deeds because you overcame them. Mm. So basically, and Hal talks about that a lot. He's like, I'm going to crop all of your glories and they're going to become mine. Mm. What is he say? Yeah. And he says, oh, man, I could better brook the loss of brittle life than those proud titles that thou hast won from me. They wound my thoughts worse than the sword in my flesh. And then he basically is just like, but thoughts are stupid.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the opposite of Hal. Like, to Hal, like, thoughts are very important. Mm. But Hotspur's a man of action. And to him, deeds matter more than words, yeah. right? And he says that constantly.
Deeds, not words.
And then he can't get his final words out. And Hal has to finish the sentence for him. And then Hotspur comes on. And, you know, and then Hal has this moment where he's like, oh my God, is Falstaff dead too? Oh my God. And I think he has to be so upset about that. And then Falstaff sits up as soon as Hal wakes up and goes, embowled? You know, like that's the first word that he says.
That was
unbelievable.
Speaking of that, that was a huge problem I had with the women's prison Henry IV that was a transfer from the Donmar.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
When she thought when that Hal saw Falstaff dead, she might as well have been talking to a piece of cardboard. It was fuck, man? Like this
yeah,
like you don't give a shit. And like
that's
so I don't
really
give
interesting.
A shit.
I don't remember that at all.
That's really interesting. Yeah, to me,
Hal,
I actually kinda lost it in that moment. Completely unexpectedly, and I hate it when that happens, you know, when you're like but it was kind of exciting because it was like it was a total discovery, and I really like I just loved the guy who was playing my Falstaff. He was so good at playing Falstaff, and when I saw him there dead, I was like, oh fuck. And I literally like I was like, why is it raining? You know, it literally was one of those moments where I just started completely tearing
exactly.
up.
Exactly. It's because you stop fucking rationalizing it
yeah.
like all these fucking actors do. And you just let yourself be carried away. Because it's, you know how you're saying that he hates thoughts? Well, yeah, it's because
thoughts are
just a rationalization of really base instincts. It's all that they are. And they can kind of be used as like a red herring and a crutch and like a smokescreen for just your basic sort of animal lusts. Because I think consciousness is. It's just an analyzed way. It's just an advanced way of analyzing our environment.
Mm.
It's just a really advanced survival mechanism.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
And so
I also think an argument can be made for not lack of feeling, but the fact that he just. I mean, the reason I love the Hollow Crown version so much is because it is dirty and
it's filthy.
And
yeah.
The war is brutal and it's horrific to watch.
It really.
And you can really see you see it in that version, but how somebody coming from just having killed their
covered in mud
opponent,
yeah,
like of course Falstaff wouldn't survive that war. Like of course Hal's gonna come out and be like, Falstaff is dead. He's like, I barely survived. There's no way this fat fucker is alive anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
well,
there's just
this,
no way. And it's like the becoming also when he takes all of Hotspur's deeds, it's like the first step in him becoming
this
what
great
King
war
Henry
hero.
Wants him to be. So it's kind of the first time he sheds
that
part of him, Falstaff part of himself.
My favorite line that Hal says when he thinks Falstaff is dead is, I could have better spared a better man.
Mm-hmm.
Which he basically is like, there's no reason that I should feel this. You are a horrible man.
Right.
You're a coward. You're a drunk. You're a cheat, you're a thief, but yet
and
why do
no
I
use
feel
to be in this battle?
But why do I feel this affected by the like I can't deal with it? And
well, that's like the other side of the coin of what Jason was saying about that thing of, you know, how Shakespeare has both the really kind of high-minded poetic stuff with the really grubby stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because the other side of it is what he says about Hotspur.
Yeah.
Which is all articulated. That all is articulated. He says, when let this body did contain a spirit,
a kingdom
for it
was
too small a bound, but now two paces of the vilest earth is room enough.
Yeah. It's that obsession with mortality, I think, that's really remarkable. You see that with Hamlet, I mean, the grave digger scene.
Mm-hmm.
You see, you know, one of my favorite lines in Hamlet is, dost thou think Alexander looked so in the earth and smelt so? Ugh. You know, it's like, to what base uses may we return? You know, yeah. And it's that, you know, it's kind of a biblical idea, but I maybe this is just because I'm not a religious person, but I think, you know, Shakespeare said it better when he's talking about the worms and death and dying. And anyway, but to go back to the tavern scene, because I feel like we've taken a huge, you know, left turn. Yeah. But still, I think what's important, and I think why we naturally transition to that, is you feel the repercussions of what happens in this act two, in the robbery, specifically the robbery, the scene with Hotspur and Lady Percy, and the tavern scene, and that haunting moment, I do, I will. It's like an earthquake happens and you feel the shock waves way after the event has happened. So the way that we deal with the end of the play is completely informed by the scene with Hotspur and Lady Percy, and by the scene with what I think is the other sort of great lovers in the play, Hal and Falstaff. Mm-hmm. You know, in a way, their relationship is so close, their friendship is so complete, that anything that affects or changes that, we really feel. It's the way that they talk about each other, even when they're insulting each other. You know, even like in the first scene when Falstaff says you are the most comparative, rascalious, sweet young prince. You know, he calls him sweet young prince. And he, you know, I was just watching that first scene with Jamie Parker and Roger Ellum. And Jamie Parker did a wonderful thing with one of the lines that has never really made sense to me, besides just you're making a joke about Falstaff being fat. But he did it so well, because it's that repetition again, and he says, well, how then come, roundly, roundly? And he said, come, roundly, roundly, you know? And it was like this hilarious moment where he just like made a pun on the word roundly. I was like, of course, because that's totally there. And you see that with, you know, when he comes in and, you know, they call him Sweet Jack, mm-hmm. and like all of these, they're very, even though they are, you know, fucking around with each other, they have very affectionate language when they're talking, even when they're insulting each other. You know, the father ruffian, there's something very tender about that, even though it is an insult.
It's interesting.
The vanity in years, there's a poetry to the insults as well.
But there is, even though it's a term of endearment, everyone calls Hal sweet,
yeah.
as we've seen.
And Sweet Jack, they call Falstaff Sweet Jack.
They call Falstaff sweet. But it is, when used for Hal, it is kind of it's also kind of like a distancing, like you'll never be one of us.
Yeah.
Like you can.
It's like a term of respect.
You can play along and, you know, we're friends, but you're not me. And you won't, I don't know. I just was thinking about that.
Yeah.
Because it is, and how infuriating that must be for Hal, because he's like, I'm just like you.
I mean,
as he says, he repeats it over and over again in the next two plays, but you know, like
a poem.
He's not, of course, but
and we see that in every scene that
and
he's in, he has that distance, especially at the end. That's so great, the end of that act when he realizes that they're all gonna have to go to war. And that's such a great, you know, it's like, oh, fun's over. And
the fun is over.
It's happened. Yeah. It's happened before they thought it was going to happen, and they're not ready, but he's got to go do it.
Yeah, and I
just
you know,
called sweet all the time.
Yeah.
That would get annoying.
Yeah.
That would be, having people remind you of your distance from them, that would be frustrating.
Especially when he's obviously, it's such a thick, because it's not something I think that would be natural for, please, historians, write in and tablingpodcast@gmail.com and tell me if I'm completely wrong about this. But it just seems very, you know, like it sort of sticks out like a sore thumb.
Right.
The crown prince coming and hanging out in literally the poorest part of town. It just doesn't seem like something that would happen. You know, and we hear about an old lord raided me in the Privy Council, raided me in the street about you, sir. Like, literally all of the king's advisors are, like, railing on Prince Harry. Mm-hmm. And we'll see it in probably one of my other favorites.
Reminds me
yeah.
of the modern Prince Harry. He was, like, the embarrassment
exactly.
of the royal family.
Exactly.
About
we
that.
Talked
yeah.
about that a bit in the intro of, like, you know, it's a similar thing, like, when Harry goes to Vegas or whatever. And we're, like, fascinated by it, even
well,
though, like...
Or if you've seen King Charles III.
Oh, oh my God.
Seen that.
I was so sad I missed that.
It's brilliant. It is really brilliant. But it's Harry, Prince Harry, and that is, I mean, it's a Shakespearean, it's sort of this Shakespearean take on the modern royal family. And Prince Harry is sort of this Hal figure. I mean, it's
yeah.
hilarious. It's, you know, dramedy. But,
yeah.
Charles III is.
It's
about,
like a fake history play about the current royal
it's
family.
It's about the current royal family.
Is it written in faux Shakespearean English?
It's written in rhyming couplets.
Fine.
It's so good.
I've heard
it's basically
phenomenal.
About what would happen if Prince Charles had to become king.
Right.
If the queen died
yeah.
and Prince Charles had to become king. And it's literally like the drama. It's
I love
amazing.
That, the like the sort
and
of historical fiction of like what could have happened.
And it's Prince Harry like going among the common people
yeah.
and like falls in love with like a commoner and like
yeah.
it's so good. He's like, we went to Sainsbury's. it's really brilliant. But anyway.
Were they shopping in Tesco? My favorite thing. What were you doing? Nothing was happening. You were shopping in Tesco's in that scene. It's my favorite directorial note I've ever heard.
Oh God.
But yeah, so I love
I'm jumping all over the place here.
Yeah,
it's
no,
too,
but it's great. I mean, and this is the natural.
Fluid. It's such a fluid play. It's just everything is.
It all connects, right?
Else.
It
yeah.
all connects, and
exactly.
and I really like after even after the I do I will, which I've always maybe this is just my interpretation of it, but I always think because that Hal is still in character when he says I do as Henry.
I like that, yeah.
Mm.
That he's in character and he's like, I do banish, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then I will is him speaking as Hal.
I like that a lot, yeah.
Because I think it's the two voices in his head, right?
Mm-hmm.
The two fathers, and it's sort of split. And I like it if he has to sort of split that. I also just love Mistress Quickly so much.
Like,
she's hilarious.
She's great.
I think... To just give even more love to Jane May, when she played Henry IV, she also played hostess. She
mm-hmm.
played Mistress Quickly. And she did it with this Midwest accent. Oh, Lordy, Doc, like one of these Harlequin
oh
players. Is ever I see? And I was like,
that's great.
The
that's
most
brilliant.
Perfect. Because it is this sort of provincial, regional thing. And it was, oh my God, it was so funny. It was like she was right out of Fargo. but anyway, it was great. I also just love... I love this sort of domestic realities. Like when Peto is just reading that note, he's reading a receipt for fuck's sake. He's like literally reading a receipt on stage. But it tells you so much about Falstaff. He ordered a full bird for himself. He ordered sauce for the bird. He ordered 2 gallons of wine and half a penny worth of bread.
Yeah.
Like it tells you so much about his diet.
Yeah.
And like, this guy must have been just like rotting. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's just unbelievable. And I love that even it's like that always makes me think that Hal is like prompted to like, he just needs some exercise. I'm going to get him a charge of foot. He's probably going to hate that. Oh, that's going to be great. He needs the exercise.
I love that speech of just how repulsed Hal is by the diet of
yeah.
the shopping list.
Yeah.
This
2 gallons?
Intolerable fuel sack.
2 gallons?
Yeah.
You know, and there's such a great opportunity. You know, Peto could just be like
two
reading
gallons.
The list, but he could also be like judging him a little too. Like, item, sack, 2 gallons. Okay, what, you know, and then it's more sack because he goes item anchovies and sack after supper.
And
like
sack for after supper, right?
Which is it's just like, come on, this is so funny. But it's always also confusing to me because Poyne seems to be Hal's like right hand man,
mm-hmm.
and then all of a sudden it turns to Peto. And some
yeah.
people see that as like
yeah.
a textual anomaly and like
mm.
that it's actually supposed to be Poyne's, but
hmm.
because they're both start with P, like Shakespeare just
huh.
forgot or whatever. But I also like the idea that Peto is sort of like his page.
Right. I mean,
he's like a younger guy. He's like probably the lowest ranking member
yeah.
of the little Falstaff gang.
Yeah.
And he comes in with Peto marching around, and I like the idea that Peto like goes with him.
Yeah,
to the
wars. I like to think that how that Poins isn't ordered around as much.
Yeah,
as
I actually it was interesting.
Be like search his pocket,
search
like
his pocket. Yeah,
my bidding. Like that's
I actually really like the choice that the Globe made. I was just watching the first scene with Hal and Falstaff, and when Poins comes in, Poins is better dressed than both Hal and Falstaff. Mm-hmm. It's like he's sort of like. Like maybe a minor nobleman that's just sort of like followed Hal to the tavern and his like because everyone hates Poins.
Right.
They're all like I've always seen it that when Falstaff is like banish Peto and everyone's like oh shut up and he's like banish Bartolf and everyone's like shut up don't be mean to Bartolf and then he's like banish Poins and everyone's like yes banish Poins he's an asshole you know and they all like hate him and I think that is a like wonderful interpretation that Poins is like
that is so
just
funny.
Like they all just hate Poins because like
that.
He's really close with Hal.
I get that sense that he is, like, sort of more of a noble...
Yeah, like a minor nobleman
right.
who's like, yeah, I'll take you to this tavern. I know everyone there.
Right.
And they're all like, this guy.
Yeah.
I really like that.
I like that a lot.
And they call him Ned.
Yeah.
Edward Poins. Ned Poins.
Ned.
Anyway. Oh, does anyone have any... I apologize. I've just gone on
We've
and on.
Just
but
hopped
I'm,
all over. Hopped all
but
over.
But does anyone have any final thoughts about Act 2? And sort of anything to do with
any
the rest of the
Any other perspectives on the Hotspurs? I feel like
or
I
the
sort
Hotspurs,
of
yeah,
dominated that section.
Well, I did want to mention so the Upstart Crows in Santa Fe did King Henry IV Part One this summer, and I was there while they were sort of just getting off book, and so they were sort of you know solidifying their ideas about the characters, and I was having a wonderful conversation with one of the kids about Hotspur, and his conclusion essentially. And the way he played the scene. Do you remember this? He did the Sterling and did the scene for us. His conclusion is like Hotspur is not afraid of anything but his wife. And so the way he played it, he was like, "Ah!" when she came in. He's like, "Oh no, Kate,
oh
I must, gotta go." And she's
oh
like,
"Oh my god,
honey." And he's like, "Oh god, don't yell at me, please." You know, like. But I love this idea, and I thought that was actually quite. There was something to be mined there. This idea that Hotspur is not afraid of anything, any man. He is terrified of his wife,
and that she is just a boss.
Yeah,
because I like that because it's like you know, as a warrior and as a nobleman, it's like I'm either fighting you or I'm lording over you. So I have all these responsibilities and I have all these duties.
Yeah,
but then you're my wife, so when I'm with you, I'm just hanging out and shooting the shit.
Yeah,
and then, like once you see my dick, well, you've seen all of me. So you're the only person who's really seen all. Of me.
Yeah,
that's really funny. And I mean, the way I think it can also be played, the first time when I did this show, there was a really wonderful, fiery, like, I guess she was my age, so she would have been 13, and she was playing Lady Percy. And we got to sometimes improvise, like, silly intermission announcements. Mm. So we would, like, have these character encounters that never actually happened in the play. And she did this one with the guy who played Hotspur, who was literally twice her height, where she comes in, and it was right after the scene was our, like, first intermission or whatever. And she goes, "Harry." And he goes, "Yes, Kate." She goes, "It was your turn to do the dishes." And she chased him off stage with a sword. And then, like, the servant came in and goes, "We beg your indulgence for a brief intermission." And that was, like, the first. But I just loved that. And I love that idea that he was only afraid of his wife with a sword. You know?
Yeah.
Part of me
so
thinks that it could also be she's the only person who's not at least a little bit afraid of him.
That's a
very
that's good
point.
Yeah.
That's, yeah.
Because, again, it's that thing. You've seen me. You know me. There's no illusion here. You know?
Even if you respect Hotspur, you got to be a little bit of afraid of him because he's such a boss.
Yeah,
you know?
He
so,
is a boss.
You know he could kill you if he didn't like you.
Yeah. Well, and that was actually, to me, that was one of the things that undercut him a little bit in the production with Tony Scher that was just at BAM where they did all of the first tetralogy, well, chronologically first tetralogy. Was that I really did like the interpretation of Hotspur. He was a little bit just like there was something a bit off, like he just didn't know how to interact with other people, and I think that was really good. But something that happened in the first scene was that both Worcester and Northumberland like slapped him. They were just like slapping him around, and I was like, "Whoa,
that would not happen to Hotspur."
Whoa, and you know, and they were like, "What a wasp stung and impatient fool art thou?" You know, and Hotspur's like. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm done. Wow. Tell your tale, good uncle. Right. And it was like really shocking to me because I was like, I just feel like Hotspur is one of those characters that no one can rein in.
No, yeah.
That's the point of his character.
He's a warrior.
He's a warrior, right. Yeah. Well, and it was really the father. But then it was, and then it kind of, doing that, again, it undercut something, the repercussions. We felt that in the second play because I was like, did you actually love your son? And he has all of this amazing language about how great his son was and about how much he misses him after he's dead.
Right.
But, like, because of that interaction, which is the only scene Northumberland's in the play, right. Like, I was like, I don't really believe you at the top of Act Two when he's, like, grieving for his son. I was like, you didn't even treat your son well. And
right.
There could have been the justification, like, you were a father and you didn't know how to express your affection or whatever, but I didn't even feel that either.
I guess it justifies Lady Percy in a different way in the second play when she's for God's sake, go not to these wars.
Oh, such a great speech.
She's basically like, you're a terrible father.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, that makes sense.
But it was also, but it also undercut Hotspur, too. Right. And that was the thing, was it just sort of undercut Hotspur's drive in the play. Interesting interpretation.
I really like him in the Hollow Crown. I think it's...
Oh, yeah, he's great. Well, and what I love about that, too, is... Alan Armstrong is the dad who plays Northumberland, he's brilliant. He was like in the RSC for like years and years and years. He played one of the most horrible characters in Dickens. He played Mr. Squeers in the 1980 like 9-hour production of Nicholas Nickleby. He was he's one of those just like genius character actors. But anyway, I loved that because it was a father and son playing Northumberland and Hotspur, like, God, they got so much for free. They got so much for free.
Yeah.
That was really,
he's
really
the best
special.
Hotspur I've ever seen, for sure.
Yeah, I thought he was great. Yeah.
For sure.
Anyway, well, thank you guys so much.
Oh,
and,
thank
you. And we will, we'll see you next week and tune in as we go on to Act 3 of King Henry IV, Part 1. Thank you so much for listening.
Yeah.